Live from the launching pad in beautiful Sedona, Arizona, it's Vortex Network News. I'm Aurora Light, and we're going to be talking today with a very interesting guest, Gilbert Erickson, continuing to talk with him about Planet X, Nibiru, whatever else you want to call it.
Well, the Chinese called it the Red Dragon
in the sky. My producer, Bill Alec.
Good morning, Aurora.
Oh, good morning, Bill. Thank you for joining Gilbert and I. I know you're quite an expert on Revelations, and we're going to get into that today. We're going to get into some prophecy. Gilbert has a website you can go to, the Millennium Prophecy. And we are going to be getting into some stuff today, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
All right. We've got a little clip here we want to play, Bill.
Yeah, this is from James McCanny back around 2003 on his radio show.
Okay.
And he talks about the incoming of Planet X. So we will play this clip.
Will we?
There seems to be some serious observation going on in the Southern Hemisphere and leaks coming out all over the place. It does appear that groups of military and professional astronomers are openly active, let's say, at the Wormwood location in Australia. Well, of course, that's what I've been saying all along. The indicators were all there. And now there are reports that a mini solar system is coming into ours. Basically, you are on your own. Be prepared. That's the best thing I can tell you.
All right. We'll cut it there. Yeah. Now, that
I would suggest that.
Okay. All right. So the mini solar system that he's referring to is the Wormwood that we're going to be talking to today with Gilbert Erickson. Thank you, Gilbert, for being with us again.
Good morning.
And tell us, what is your opinion on the news and how they've been handling this this event, this Wormwood? Have we been getting much, would you say, on the mainstream news? Has little bits and pieces managed to leak out? Or what's going on in that arena?
Well, my impression of it is that what they're basically trying to do is they're basically attempting to manage it the best they can, but that, you know, from time to time things do slip out.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, you know, it's not until you analyze it post facto that it begins to dawn on you what has happened. A real good case, I suppose, is the stuff that's been happening with the all the hoopla around the BP oil spill.
Okay, how does that tie in your estimate?
Well, one of the problems that Wormwood throws bodacious, hellacious gravitational and electromagnetic field, and so Wormwood is pulling on the solar system from over on the June solstice side and on the southern side of the ecliptic plane. And as it pulls down, it doesn't just pull down on Earth, it pulls down on all the planets. But the outer planets were the ones where we noticed it the most because it was measurable. But it pulls down on Earth too, which means it is stressing the mantle underneath the tectonic plates.
Okay.
In the Gulf, what we had was a situation where the geologists noted that there appeared to be that the floor of the Gulf of Mexico was rising slightly.
I've heard you mention that before. They actually were able to measure that there was a rise in the level of the Gulf, because I used to live in Sarasota, Florida, by Siesta Key there. Mm-hmm. And how long has this been going on, this rising of the sea level?
Not the rising of the sea level, the rising of the seabed at the bottom.
Okay, wouldn't that raise the water too?
Standing above the top of it was decreasing. The seafloor was coming up slightly.
Well, you know, that's also occurring over there, I think, near Australia, wasn't it?
Coral Sea.
Yes.
Yeah, there was a report that one of the buoys was measuring the column height of the water and that it hit a period where it started to rise something on the order of 13 feet a day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my
goodness. If it kept rising like that, you know, at 13 feet a day, the next thing you know, you've got the seafloor is going to start emerging up out of the ocean. You're going to have dry land appearing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, what in the world could account for dry land appearing up out of the ocean?
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got a real problem to try to justify geologically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, back to the Gulf. The same kind of thing where the sea floor supposedly was rising, but only very slightly. But it was enough that it was measurable, supposedly. All right, now, what you have then is this combination of the tug of Wormwood plus its electromagnetic massaging, if you would, plus you've got this fault line that runs up and down the Mississippi River Valley. And does the word New Madrid or New Madrid fault line ring a bell? And guess where the Deepwater Horizon was drilling? Just extend that line down and you're on a major fault line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you think that was deliberate?
I think so, but...
Well, Gilbert...
Let me finish. I think so. But the reason why they would want to go digging or drilling in an area where the seabed was rising is because if they knew that there was oil there, which they did, then the slight increase in pressure from underneath the tectonic plate would increase the pressures on the oil-bearing zones, making it easier and cheaper to extract oil, which is why they did that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's cheaper and you get more oil.
Right.
It's good drilling practice if you can get more oil to drill where you're going to find more oil, and it's easier to get it out.
Right.
Okay. So I mean, that part of that made good sense. Then they screwed it up. But you know, separate problems. But the point is that here you're sitting on this zone that's already a little bit weak,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got this tugging from the Wormwood Dark Body Star that's pulling, and the electromagnetic massaging that makes the core hotter and that makes the plastic mantle, it's kind of like Play-Doh, makes it a little bit more moldable and supple, and then it starts to heave upward just slightly. I mean, if you just had it heave upward 10 or 20 feet down below, I mean, for 5 miles, 6 miles away, that doesn't seem like much, but it puts tremendous pressure on the oil that's captured in the plate. So it makes it easy to get it out. And so that's why they went after it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a cheaper way to extract oil.
Well, Gilbert,
that makes sense,
Well, Gilbert, how about considering this hypothesis that I have? I have this feeling, okay? I have this feeling that BP was ordered to drill there, to do this, to make this look like a man-made effect, when in fact the plates are actually breaking up.
It is entirely possible, and they would keep that extremely dark. They don't want people to know
if
it's true.
Yes. And then I saw this report by Nancy Pelosi just this week on Drudge that she's ordering no investigation of the BP oil disaster. I don't know if you saw that report.
No, I did not.
Yeah, that was on Drudge.
There was an interesting thing on YouTube where they showed a bulge that
the
remotely operated vehicle is down there.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the ground, if you would, at the seafloor, starts to bulge upward, and the next thing you know, it burps a massive methane burp, and everything, you know, is swirled in swirling mud.
Right.
So it is unstable, and there's a lot of cracks and fissures. And where you have methane at 60,000 psi, I mean, that stuff is going to start penetrating if you've got cracks and fissures overhead. It needs a nice clean dome without cracks and without fissures. And then they're sitting on top of a geologically unstable area. It's being pushed up from underneath, so it's already under extra pressure. And then if you start drilling into it, you really are asking for trouble. Well, we got it. So, you know, were they ordered to go and get trouble? I mean, that's turning out to be, what was it, $5, $6 billion worth of trouble?
And there's a chance, actually, that a large amount enough of methane gas could be ignited, you might say, by all this, to actually create a huge problem, like an explosion.
Right.
But well, you could get that if it comes up. Remember, a lot of the methane is going to be trapped in the ocean water itself. It's extremely cold down below. Okay? Mm-hmm. And the cold water will absorb very, very large amounts of gases, oxygen, nitrogen, methane, carbon dioxide, whatever. So cold water holds on to the gases a lot better than warm water. But as that stuff slowly works its way, you know, closer to the surface, or it starts to run in a channel that makes it come up shallow, like when it goes around the Florida Keys, then it's going to be coming warmer, and it's going to be released. There's also a lot of bacteria that will eat, you know, help themselves and eat some of it. So it's going to be spread around. I don't know if it's so much a danger from massive explosion as it's just, you know, it's lost value. I mean, that's a lot of natural gas we could be doing cooking with, instead of being vomited into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it represents a massive economic loss.
Environmental.
The whole situation was bad.
Yeah, environmentally, it's tragic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the methane will clean itself up, so to speak. If it gets released out of the ocean, even piecemeal, spread out all the way around the Florida Keys and up the coastline of you know, the Carolinas or whatever. But, I mean, if it gets released into the atmosphere, methane will very slowly migrate up toward the stratosphere and then up into the ionosphere. And then it actually slowly will distribute itself. It helps to rebuild the ozone layer. And then it distributes itself farther and farther up into the ionosphere until finally it actually wisps off into space. Methane is too light for the gravity of the Earth to hang on to it permanently. I mean, it just migrates slowly to the upper atmosphere, and it sort of evaporates from the planet, if you would, because our gravity here on Earth isn't strong enough to hold it.
Well, that's interesting. So, I hadn't heard it explained that way before. Thank you for sharing that. You know, the wormwood information dovetails into so many things that are going on the planet right now. Wouldn't you say, in people's subconscious minds as well, that there is kind of like this group subconscious mind that we have that is feeling where something's on the way?
Well, there certainly is a growing sense of impending doom, you know, all the 2012 movies and Mayan prophecy kinds of things and biblical prophecy kinds of things, and then, you know, governments that appear to have arranged to make things, you know, basically economically go to hell in a handbasket, and plus, you know, constant tension and fighting,
groups
vying for this, that, and the other.
Yes. Yeah,
everybody with an agenda.
So with it, people's heads being spun around in so many different directions, let's focus on, just for our audience, so that we can recap a little bit about the evidence about wormwood out there.
Okay. Remember, in our prior show, we started talking about that. The problem was that people were saying that there is no evidence that wormwood is coming. I started from the biblical point of view, and I pointed out that, you know, that the Revelation gives it that title, wormwood or bitterness, and it also uses the word star in the same sentence. So starting from that point of view, I had to try to fill in the blank spots as to what that would mean, because when the revelation comes true, it's going to come true with physical results as a prophecy. There will be a physical result to that. And so we covered that in the prior show, and people can always, you know, they can come up on your website and download that on MP3 or just right there, you know, live off of your website. So they can listen to that anytime now. Anyway, the main evidence was that physical evidence that Wormwood is coming, that it is there, and that it is doing something, is the fact that it started all the way back in 1821 with a perturbation of the orbits of the outer planet. At that time, that was Uranus. They didn't know about Neptune. And when Uranus was over on the December side of what would be Earth's orbit extended out,
mm-hmm.
it had a near-perfect circle orbit. But
right.
when it was on the June side, there was a dip in the orbit. And when Alexis Bouvard measured that, Uranus was off track by 1 degree, which was 10 times his measurable error. He was not making a mistake. And other astronomers confirmed it. It was suggested that there'd be another planet that would perturb or disturb the orbit of Uranus, and in 1865, Neptune was found. And the only problem with that theory was Neptune also was disturbed or perturbed. It had a different orbit on the June side of the solar system than it had on the December side of the solar system. And both Uranus and Neptune have nearly, not perfectly, but nearly perfect circular orbit. So it's easy to tell if something goes wrong. We know where they ought to be. So if they're not there, then it's a legitimate question. Why are they not there? Anyway, we covered all that in the first show. So this is physical evidence pointing to something being wrong. Now, I came at it from the point of view of trying to harmonize biblical prophecy, trying to fill in the blank spots, if you would, of the book of Revelation. Right? And so that's where I was coming from. So as I filled in this conceptual science, this is kind of the model that comes out. You basically are just assuming that Wormwood, like any other orbiting body, is going to have certain characteristics. They orbit around another body that's heavier, and they usually have some kind of a regular pattern, and they spin on an axis, because this is what orbiting bodies do. Okay? Our sun spins on an axis.
Okay.
The Earth spins on an axis. All the planets spin on their axes.
Right.
The moons spin on an axis as they orbit the planets, and so on and so on. So if it's doing what other orbiting bodies do, then it will be doing some of these same kinds of things too. So you sort of fill in that blank spot the same way, which is what I did.
Which is to mean, okay, that it's on a trajectory course that can be charted, in other words.
Exactly. Now, we were told, and I don't want to go into this right now, but we were told that basically what they thought was that it was a brown dwarf star, probably as much as 60 times Jupiter's mass, somewhere between the size of Saturn and the size of Jupiter, and that it, you know, it's going to have this highly elliptical orbit on the southern side of the ecliptic plane. Okay, no problem. Where would it be coming from on its inbound trajectory? And that's what I announced last year in that interview with George Norrie on Coast to Coast. We made the big announcement that it would be coming in on what we call right ascension 18, which basically is a line that comes up between Sagittarius and Scorpius. If you look out at the southern sky at night, you can see the scorpion with the scorpion's tail, especially during the summer. And on the left side is Sagittarius, looks like a teapot, or it looks like an archer, depending on your point of view. We like to think of it as a teapot because it looks like a teapot trying to pour hot water on the scorpion's tail. Well, right ascension 18 is just off the tip star of Sagittarius. So between Sagittarius and Scorpius, two very large constellations, is this line, and you know, that astronomers refer to as right ascension 18. they divide the night sky up into 24 hours. And the stars appear to come up out of the, you know, from the left, they ascend and they move over toward the right, and then they descend on the right side. So it's called right ascension. Actually, it's the opposite southern hemisphere, but it's still called right ascension.
Hmm.
Anyway, instead of calling it degrees, they refer to it as hours of right ascension. Because
okay.
every night they have to sit there, and they have to keep their servo motors running like a clock to compensate for the movement of the Earth as the Earth spins on its axis. If they want to look at a fixed point in space, the Earth is never still. It's always moving. So because the Earth is moving underneath them, they have to have a way to adjust their telescopes in real time. So they basically have the telescopes moving around and in on a circle that corresponds to the speed of the rotation of the Earth. All right? And then they have to also adjust the azimuth.
Okay. And
this is all done with servo motors and computers now, but the point is that because the Earth is moving, you have to have a way to allow your telescope to also be moved, because if you freeze the telescope in any one position, then it'll track right off of what it was you were looking at.
Exactly.
And it starts looking at something else. All
right? Right.
So anyway, right ascension 18 is where Wormwood is coming in from. That is its inbound trajectory, and we announced that last year. Of course, the astronomy community is just dead silent.
Now, does your theory on this, the position that it's coming in on, is that in conflict with some of the other people who have been out there since, Bill knows, he's been reading about on the Internet for many years that it's coming in?
Well, there's a number of people out there saying that, well, it's coming in inbound near the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And they're showing this optical effect of mm-hmm. a second sun or something.
Oh, yeah. The double sun theories. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. What's your thoughts about that?
Okay. Yes and no.
Okay.
Yes and no. It depends. Let me see if I could paint this picture for you. If the Earth could sit in the June 21st orbital position, not orbit, just sit there and spin on its axis, then what you would see as you tracked Wormwood is you would see it coming. You'd have to look at it first in the southern hemisphere sky, because you can't see it in the northern hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
What you would see is Wormwood slowly descending, as you observed it with infrared telescope, slowly descending down past Pavo and Era and so forth in a straight line. Every night you'd come around and take a look, and it would be dropping a little more, getting a little bigger, and so on. And it would come straight down that line, right down between Sagittarius and Scorpius, the two constellations. That's right ascension 18. And it would move in a straight line. Okay. When it got to a certain point, as it got very close in, it would start to appear to be getting much bigger. Okay? But it would still stay right on that line if we could stay in the June 21st orbital position. And it would run right up between Sagittarius and Scorpius, and then it would start to get much bigger and much bigger and much bigger, and it would fly right overhead in that straight line. That's why the ancients called it the planet of the crossing. Planet of the crossing, Nibiru. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It was also called the bull calf of the sun. Now, this thing is not behaving like a normal planet going around and following the zodiac.
Hmm.
It is cutting across everything, the planet of the crossing. That's where those names come from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But the problem is that the Earth can't sit in the June 21st orbital position. So as you watch the night sky in June 21st, you know, it's coming right up a straight line. Blip, blip, blip. Every time you come around and look at it each night, you get this slow movement. In the southern hemisphere, it's coming down toward the horizon. that when it breaks up above the horizon, as viewed from the northern hemisphere, it's coming up the horizon. Okay? Up through.
Okay.
And right along, right ascension 18. But the Earth doesn't sit still in the June 21st orbital position. Okay? The Earth is moving 1 degree per day.
Mm-hmm.
365 degrees per year. 365 and a quarter days per year. So it's just a tick under 1 degree of orbital movement in addition to spinning on an axis, 360 degrees in 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this constant movement and repositioning of the Earth that gives you the different perspectives of what it is that you're looking at. The heavens aren't out there moving as fast as the orbit of the Earth and the spin of the Earth makes it appear. Okay? Mm. It's the Earth's movement that makes the stars look like they're moving. They're not moving quite like we think they are.
Mm-hmm.
Much slower, perspective-wise. But the Earth is spinning so fast and orbiting so fast.
I wasn't aware the stars were moving at all, I guess.
Yeah, well, they are, but, you know, it's not quite the same. Anyway, the point is that they're not moving quite the way that we are in terms of changing perspective. All right. Because the Earth is spinning and orbiting, we can't sit on the June 21st position and observe it. Now, what would happen if that same movement were viewed from, say, the November or the January observing positions? Well, in the November observing position, as you looked over past the sun, at a certain point you would see a double sun, and the little one would be over to the left of the sun. But in the January position, if you were observing late January, and this thing came up and you saw reflected light, then it would appear that it was over on the right side of the sun. So where Wormwood would appear to be relative to the sun, if you're over on the December side of the solar system, depends on where you are. On November, it would look like it's over on the left. January, February, it looks like it's over on the right. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The double sun theory. So if Wormwood was to break up above the horizon while we're over on the December side, then yes, you would have that, you could have that picture, if you would.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Now, I don't think that it'll work quite that way because, again, we can see it over where we are now. Here we are in August, and we've gone past the June 21st solstice line, if you would. And that's the line that it's coming inbound on as we stretch that line out, right ascension 18. And, you know, so all we have to do is just look over the night sky, you know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and there it is. Now, if you're in the southern hemisphere, you can see it coming up at us, coming up toward the, you know, from the southern side toward the ecliptic plane. If you're in the northern hemisphere, you can't see it yet because
mm-hmm.
it's too far south.
Oh,
but
okay.
It is coming up at us.
Some websites are saying that you can see it.
Pardon me?
Some websites are saying that you can see it in the northern hemisphere.
I don't believe so.
Mm. Okay. But so, now, you know, there's so much to think about in regards to all this. Do any astronomers out there who are amateur astronomers, do they have the right equipment to be able to see this approaching?
All right. First off, remember that Wormwood is a dark body star. Probably a good bit of it is covered in, you know, iron sulfides. Iron sulfides are black.
Okay. So they're hard
to
spot.
It's also covered with a lot of iron oxide. This stuff is really not very conducive to reflecting light.
Right.
It will. If mm-hmm. you get a bright enough light and it gets close enough, you're going to be able to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Blotchy red-black thing looking, you know.
Yeah.
But the point is, if it doesn't give off any light, reflected light, or very little reflected light, plus, it, you know, it's volcanic and it's electromagnetic action, it's throwing one bodacious, hellacious, rusty, dusty disk.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got all this, you know, garbage that it is lofting electromagnetically up into its upper atmosphere, performing, you know, producing this massive disk of iron oxide. So it's a mess. And
so
it's
pretty
not going to reflect a lot of light.
So it's pretty much red, would you say?
Well, a combination of red and black.
Yeah.
All right? But it's not very reflective. Now, it's probably warm. In other words, when we have a volcano here on Earth, it gives off heat. So the surface of Wormwood is probably a little bit warm. All right, now, if you've got this rusty, dusty, not very reflective surface, and you try to get a picture of it, you have to borrow some light from somewhere. So it's got to be reflecting light. If it doesn't reflect very well, it's hard to see. But if it's warm, it shows up in the infrared. Okay? Now, most astronomers, amateur astronomers, do not have this kind of instrumentation for their scopes. They have eyepieces and sometimes camera mounts. That's what they have. This is what they can afford. See, if you're the U.S. government or the, you know, the ESO or something, you can afford millions and millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of instrumentation. You can have ultraviolet. You can have spectrum splitters. You can have infrared. You can have near-infrared, far-infrared, you know, various bands of infrared. You can split things up. You can have X-ray. You can have radio telescope. You can have all kinds of things, Arecibo. You can have all kinds of nifty instrumentation. But where are the astronomers, you know, amateur astronomers going to get the money for that kind of equipment? So most of them are, you know, they've got, if they're, they may have saved up for years to get themselves a, you know, $10,000, $12,000 Dobson rig or something. And they can see some pretty spectacular stuff on a clear night. But what are they looking at it with? Answer, eyeballs. That's their instrument. So if you've got something out there that's not very reflective, are you going to see it? Okay? It's a dark body star. It does not give off visible light. It's too small. Okay, so if you don't have infrared equipment and the ability to do blink comparison, flashing back and forth between infrared, optical, infrared, optical, infrared, optical, because it shows up in infrared, but it does not show up in the optical. So how many people are equipped with that capability? I think it was the ESO just went online, was it this year or late last year, with the ability to do infrared and optical blink comparison electronically in real time. Do you know how much money that thing is worth?
I can't even imagine.
Millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why in the world would they want to do that? Because they can chart and plot and compare infrared signature with optical signature. They can chart, plot, compare X-ray, ultraviolet. They can split the spectrum up and start looking at things from different perspective points of view with respect to the kind of light and the kind of radiation that the bodies in space give off.
It's a shame that there isn't.
So how many amateurs are equipped with that kind of money?
So there's really no lab out there, astronomy lab, that's going to be able to release this kind of information if they want to keep getting their donations.
How about that?
That's a bit of a quandary, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, where does your paycheck come from?
Yeah, exactly.
What happens when somebody threatens your paycheck?
Exactly. Now, what about Robert S. Harrington? Can we get into a little bit about him?
Yeah. That was the next, as we went through some of the stuff of the physical evidence, remember, what happened was on the, in 1982, NASA used the line scan from the two different Pioneer satellites, and that was infrared. But that produces a very grainy image. So the next year they had lofted the IRAS satellite, IRAS, Infrared Observatory Astronomic Satellite or something, IRAS. And that had an onboard cryostat. with the onboard cryostat, they were able to see some things quite beautifully, actually. It was a very good instrument. And because it was up above the atmosphere, no distortion of any kind, so they get a pure signal. And I think that's when they nailed down exactly where Wormwood was and what it was, what it looked like and what was coming. And that scared the crap out of them. All of a sudden, we started getting misinformation, disinformation. And a year afterwards...
Now, what year was that, did you say?
That would have been 1983.
Okay.
And supposedly in 1984, it ran out of helium.
There was
an astronomer, one of the team members who was on the team or knew about it or was somehow connected with it in some way, was a NASA staffer, who said that 5 years after it supposedly ran out of helium, that he knew of, it was running. They were still getting good pictures with it. So that was a lie.
Okay.
All right. Now, Robert S. Harrington worked with Tom Van Flandern at the U.S. Naval Observatory. And he did a long series of runs, computer simulations, way back in the old Fortran batch processing days. You guys remember those punch cards?
Oh, yeah.
You remember that, Bill?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I come from that era.
Okay, good. So we're about the same era. All right. In the old punch card days, you know, where you do the batch processing on the computer, and he used to do that. He would go, he took the data of the tracking data that was available, going all the way back into the, I guess, the late 1700s, and he would track the Uranus tracking data, and using the standard formula for perturbation, try to figure out where Wormwood would be coming from based on the way it had a tendency to reach out and grab the planets, pardon the pun, by the balls and pull on the planets to get them to go off track. Whereas when they got out over on the June solstice side, why did they go squirrely over there? Okay, now we've raised this question before. And he was trying to answer that question. He did something like 336,000 computer runs. He would do several batches at a time. This was over a period of something like 12 years. And he came to the conclusion that the best estimate was that Wormwood would be coming inbound somewhere between right ascension 14 and right ascension 20. But that a good place to start looking would be roughly about right ascension 16. Well, we're getting pretty close now, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
What he did then was he said, okay, look, the planets do their funny dance on the June side.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, April, May, June, Uranus starts to pull down off track. And in 1983, they could see, well, Neptune is out there, and, whoa, look at that. Neptune's off track, too. And when Uranus comes flying by in the neighborhood of Neptune, of course, they pull toward each other. But then as Uranus continues and leaves the way, Neptune is still out there by itself and is still being pulled down.
Mm-hmm.
And then as it comes around again, of course, then it goes back on track and back into a fairly close, you know, fairly close to a perfect circular orbit. So using the, you know, the standard physics formula called the formula for perturbation, he figured out that the odds had to be at least 5-1 that Wormwood was pulling on the outer planets from the southern side of the ecliptic, probably best guesstimate, place to go look, right ascension 18, and anywhere between 14 and 20. Notice you get this big, huge swath of sky, southern hemisphere sky. And if you're going to find it, the odds are 5-1, you had to go looking there. Now, he released that report, and it was done, I guess, May of 88, and it was published in October of 88, and then it was updated a little bit, I think, a year or two later. But when the IRIS information was let go, remember, what they told the public was, well, we don't have incoming mail. And if you guys want to go looking for it, why don't you go look over there at Orion. Yeah, you go look at Orion. But that's right ascension 6.
Mm-hmm.
And that's northern hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why would they tell you to look at right ascension 6?
The opposite direction.
The exact opposite direction, northern hemisphere, when it's coming in on 18, southern hemisphere.
Well, obviously, they want you looking in the wrong spot.
da 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 da. How about that?
Yeah. So, okay. So we've been. Well, in other words, they want to keep this information highly secret. So
that's
that
right.
They can prepare.
Now, what would make NASA and the powers that be want to sit on and hold and contain this kind of information?
Well, because they don't want us to prepare. They are going to prepare, but
right.
They're not going to bother with us.
Exactly.
The
so what,
does,
what started happening back in those years that we're seeing massive amounts of now, especially in the last 10 years? What are they digging into the earth?
They have been notoriously, actually, in Sedona here, we've actually had reports from the locals of truckloads of things coming, being delivered at night to homes that they buy. They loaded the stuff into the house, of course, taken down,
over there by Boynton,
down
Virginia.
Into the secret shaft. Mm-hmm. Into the tunnel. Then when they're done unloading all the stuff, they seal over the shaft, and they put the home up for sale, and they move on.
They have the secret
underground
base.
They've been doing that all
there.
Over.
Or access to a base.
And every
that's
night
right
they'll deliver
here.
A whole truckload full of stuff. These are houses that are, you know, on a few acres so that the houses next door can't hear them or anything. But this has been going on and observed. And
Denver Airport, does that ring a bell?
Denver Airport, Pandora's
yeah,
Box, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Now, what about Area 51? What about the complexes up in Utah? What about under Washington?
Yeah, they're all underground.
What about underground? New Mexico?
And New
there's
Mexico,
a big
yeah.
One. There's a big one out there. It's not at Area 51. There's another place that's been described as an underground city. You know, with manufacturing
what
capability.
What was the Taos hum for years
that
on
be,
end?
That
was
that,
them
would
digging
that be in
downstairs.
New Mexico?
Yeah, that was the Taos hum was them digging the underground facility downstairs.
And Jesse Ventura had a thing, a show on the telly about that.
Oh, did
so
he?
What have the elites been doing while they tell you to go look at Orion and they're looking in the opposite direction? Something scares the hell out of them, and they start digging tunnels
yeah.
and underground bunkers.
Yeah, exactly. All over the Southwest, especially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I know, and we're not supposed to connect those dots.
No.
Right.
Oh no. And then the CIA. There's a report just a couple of weeks ago that the CIA completed their moving to Denver area.
Yeah, they're moving them away from Virginia.
Yes.
To Denver.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Denver is about 5,000 feet up. It's up on the, you know, the high plains.
Right. We all were all wondering why they, you know, why they chose an airport to be situated in such a bizarre location, because it picks up the wind very easily. You know, when the planes are coming in, mm-hmm. It's very difficult for them to land there in Denver and take off because it's so windy. Where they chose this location, it's so high up, but apparently. They wanted an airport that was high up for a reason.
How about that? Mm-hmm. So they take taxpayers' money and they dig massive underground bunker complexes for themselves and their friends, their families.
Uh-huh.
And they tell you, now you go over there and look at Orion. Yuck, yuck, yuck. Where you're not going to see anything, and we know that. But we're going to go over here and we're going to establish underground bunker complexes. And let's see, while we're at, what the hell, let's just throw in, let's get a South Pole telescope up and running, infrared only, and let's put it at the South Pole and spend a couple $100 million to sustain it, and we'll have all these stories about neutrinos and budinos and wooinos and ha-ha-ha-hinos or whatever.
And maybe that's why the Pope's got his telescope over here in Arizona.
Well, he does, but his is up on Mount Graham over there where a lot of the others, you know, Kitt Peak, mm-hmm. and the, there's a lot of, telescope facilities there. It's a good place to go looking.
But I mean,
but
why
if you wanted to track Wormwood inbound from
the
southern hemisphere side, you would have to have a southern hemisphere location, which they have. There's two real good ones. Great ones, actually. Okay, so they know exactly where to plot. Now, since we let this information out to the public knows, too. They just don't have the money to buy the instrumentation. to do the same kind of tracking.
Well, you know, my monkey here in the production room here is monkeying around while you're talking here, giving me all kinds of signals. One of them being that we have to wind this up here in a few minutes here. And, you know, I feel like we didn't get through our list of things we wanted to talk about today. But, you know, we are trying to make it clear to those listening, those of you out there listening, that there is something going on here of great seriousness, that even though it's being ignored in the mainstream media, do not ignore what we are saying.
Exactly.
Because there is substance to this, and there is weight to this. I want you to understand, folks, those of you listening out there, that this is a weighty subject that you need to look into, dwell on yourself, and decide if you're going to, you know, maybe take some precautions of some kind. I would suggest getting in my book, Prepare for the Landings, we talk about this time coming up when the ships are going to have to evacuate many of the light workers here on the planet who wish a better way, those who wish a better way and have been trying with their intentions to live, you know, decent lives, up trying to do their bit to uplift the planet each in their own way, that there are advanced worlds up there that are being prepared for them to return to, and those who are graduating to another level. There are supposed to be three waves of evacuation, actually, we've been told. The first one, I think, will be around the Wormwood period. And then the other two are supposed to come during the tribulation, you know, at some point. I'm not quite sure on the biblical connection to the prophecies.
Well, there's a pre, a mid, and then a post.
Pardon me?
There's essentially three waves of evacuation.
That's right.
There's
that's what we've been told.
The pre-trib, the mid-trib, and then the post-trib.
Okay. So, you know, I think I'm going in the first one.
The first
wave, I've already been told, actually,
yeah.
The 144,000, the original core group of volunteers to come here to this planet, is going in the first wave.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming back with their higher powers and abilities, and they are then going to help the others graduate so that they can advance to more what you'd say, less Luciferian influence in their life. This planet has been in quarantine now for a long time because of Luciferian influence here, and we are going to have to liberate it. And this is part of the liberation, really, is to let this happen, this Wormwood pass through, as predicted and really planned. And so, Gilbert, it's interesting having you on. I thank you so much for your scientific studies as well as your biblical studies. And trying to put those both together is quite a challenge. But, you know, I think you're doing a magnificent job. Keep up the good work. And we'll talk to you again next week and get a little more into this subject. So those of you out there, I want you to have a beautiful week, and remember that each and every day we have the ability to make it a better place for all of us, and take advantage of those opportunities that come your way to lighten the load of a friend, a neighbor, or a stranger, and a relative. You know, think about what you can do to lighten other people's loads and make it easier for all of us here on the planet. And, Gilbert, thank you so much for giving us your expertise. And your website is Millennium Prophecy.
At www.millenniumprophecy.com.
And you have a book there that people can download, correct?
Yeah, you can order the book there. It's an e-book.
Right.
And it's The Millennium Prophecy. And you order it at millenniumprophecy.com. wormwood.com.
And in that book, you were able to go into a lot more detail, too, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. I lay this all out, the order of events, how they'll happen, what's going on, the background science, a lot of doctrine, how the whole Bible and prophecy and the physical events fit together, and then what the millennium will be like the 1,000 years after this tribulation period is over. Most of it is devoted to the tribulation, but then there's another whole large chapter, and it takes a long list of biblical references and describes what the 1,000 years of peace under the reign of Jesus Christ will be like when he gets here.
Mm-hmm.
Very involved.
Wow. Well, I guess we'll all have space travel by that time. We'll be coming and going regularly from this planet once it's liberated.
Well, it does say that he's coming back with the armies of heaven. That's armies, plural, more than one of them.
That's right.
Plural, armies
my understanding,
of heaven, Revelation 19.
There is a federation out there of planets that have taken oaths to uphold the divine plan throughout the galactic realms and fight the Luciferian rebellion. And not allow the Luciferians to take over our technology as well as our, other things that we have here on this planet that we don't want to share with Luciferians who are going to use it for control and manipulation and enslavement.
That's what they do.
Yeah. So we're here as the Liberation Armies of Light, some of us in Earth embodiment, and an Armageddon of light workers working around this planet for this day that's coming up of liberation of planet Earth. And if you read the book, Prepare for the Landings, as well, I think you're going to get more in-depth information. I think these are two good books to prepare yourself and those you love, The Millennium Prophecy and Prepare for the Landings. And you can go to prepareforthelandings.com. And get involved in what is truly going on right in the here and now. This is no fairy tale. This is something that's reality that is not being talked about on CNN. And that's why we created Vortex Network News, to have people like Gilbert Erickson on, to be able to, to take the chokehold off these people who want to come forth with this information that to enlighten you and inform you on things that you're never going to get in the mainstream news. It's too controlled. There's too much emphasis on, well, we're the ones who know the truth, and you're the ones who we want to keep in the dark so that we can continue to manipulate you right up to the very end.
Pretty sad.
Yes. They don't want the stock market falling before the end of the world, I guess.
Well, actually, that's just about to happen anyway because of their own stupidity, but that's a separate problem.
Well, it's their own greed.
Yeah, that it has a way of destroying itself.
Yes,
over time.
Yes, it does. And we're seeing the prophecies unfold right before our very eyes. And I want to remind people that in Revelations it talks about this time that when the Jews will return home to Israel. That was 1948. It didn't happen until then. And the deserts begin to bloom as though it were oases. They never had irrigation until the 1950s and 60s when they started to build irrigation in Israel. That the children who are born then will usher in the beginning of the end. And that generation will not pass before these things happen. So a generation in the Bible is 70 years. We are right in those days, right here, right now. So, thank you so much, and blessings to everyone. Let's have a great week here, and productivity, and faith, and the fact that the divine plan is unfolding as should, and each and every one of us is protected from on high. So, keep your faith in God, and your faith in your fellow man. Love and light to y'all. I'm Aurora Light, and stay tuned for the Progressive Tech Hour with William Alec.